Hi, Lauren.
Hi.
Are we alone?
Yeah, I guess we're early.
I am. Oh, okay, I have to take still a minute. Okay.
Just another minute.
Yeah.
I'm usually late.
And usually early. Here's someone else. Fine. Okay. Hi, Douglas. Doug.
Greetings.
Hello, John.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello, Marco Morelli.
Hi.
Hello, Marco Massi.
Hi, Marco Morelli. Why is my video?
Are we going to meditate before we start? Hello?
Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
Mateo, I guess, is not going to be here. So I volunteered to be his understudy and to offer something at the beginning that's interactive that I hope that will stimulate a conversation. Just let me know when you guys are ready to start. Are we going to wait a few more minutes, Marco?
Well, it's up to you. I'm just checking to make sure that this is recording and everything is functional.
And this is likely everyone that planned on showing up. I know Jeffrey and, as you mentioned, John, Mateo won't be here, so.
Okay. I'm waiting for this fire truck to go down the street. Okay, I can hear it fading away in the distance. So I just read these two chapters today at the library. And I had, as usual, lots of mixed feelings. So I wanted to invite all of us to, I posted a list on the forum, Michael Murphy's list of metanormal capacities. Did everyone get a chance to look at that? You got Marco? Tony, did you see it?
I've seen it, but I thought that this chapter was especially interesting. I thought it was one of the better chapters. So maybe we could do both, discuss the chapter and with through the lens maybe of Michael Murphy's Future of the Body.
Well, yeah, I think that's a good idea. So if you saw that list, I would appreciate it if you would just make a note of any of those capacities that you were attracted to, or that you've actually had a robust experience of. I believe these are all like surface structures of a deeper structure that I believe would help us ground some of the insights that Aurobindo that are lavishly displayed in these two chapters. So Michael Murphy is a scholar who wrote this really magnificent book, The Future of the Body. He spent a lot of time in Oroville. I don't know if he met Aurobindo, but I knew he knew the mother pretty well. And I believe he has done a masterful job of bringing forward some of the insights that Aurobindo had, and sort of integrating it into a postmodern kind of milieu. I think he's Esalen. I haven't been to Esalen, but I've been very close by. It's a spectacular landscape, and it's near San Francisco, so it's a very different culture, I think, than the one that Aurobindo was working with at Oroville. Much more postmodern, I think Banerjee would agree, as he taught, I think, not at Esalen, but I think he taught at in San Francisco, at the Center of the Institute for Integral Studies, I think, yeah. So anyway, I'm just quoting him from his book. He's quoting Aurobindo. And Aurobindo was very critical of a lot of the prohibitions against cities or special powers, because there are in the traditions many warnings about getting caught up in these cities or seeking power through these cities. But he was skeptical of that. I just wanted to quote him. I don't know exactly where this is from, but it's a quote that Michael Murphy offers of Sri Aurobindo. We need not shun the cities and cannot shun them. There is a stage reached by the yogin when, unless he avoids all action in the world, he can no more avoid the use of cities of power and knowledge than an ordinary man can avoid eating and breathing. But these things are the natural action of consciousness to which he is rising, just as mental activity and physical motion are the natural action of man's ordinary life. All the ancient rishis use these powers. All great avatars and yogins have used them. Nor is there any great man who does not use them continually in an imperfect form without knowing clearly what are these supreme faculties that he is enjoying. So I also got a little chart from this book. This is Michael Murphy's chart. And maybe you could help me with this, Marco, because you are an author yourself of integral practice. So I believe you're probably familiar with this research too. Can you see this little chart? You got, this is the vertical, and this is the horizontal, and the vertical is the spiritual transcendence of yogis in a trance. And you see, this is the material conditions, such as he offers examples of genetic engineering or prosthetic devices. This would be material development. And this diagonal line is the integral development of mind-body complexes. So you can see between on this vertical line, and between this vertical line and the diagonal line, there are little lines, which indicates for him the different spiritual practices that are engaged in by different yogis from different traditions that are that area where these cities tend to arise. So I hope that's semi-articulate there. So anyway, if you've had a chance to look at that list, and if anyone would like to create some sort of rapport with me and with the group so that you can feel safe and secure about expressing yourself about this. Because I know some people are kind of shy about talking about this stuff, but I'm not. I talk about this stuff all the time. But if you do have a sense of one of these metanormal capacities that Murphy makes a list of, please feel free to raise a hand or make a comment.
I'll just say that I definitely do, but not the fancy stuff, not the really weird stuff. It's weird for me in a particular way, and it particularly expresses itself, which Aurobindo doesn't so much talk about in this chapter on the evolution of the spiritual man, in the aesthetic or the creative. I feel that that is coming from a spiritual source, and that it's attempting to work itself into the world through me, partially through me. And so part of my orientation has to be to negotiate or to mediate between the various levels of being that Aurobindo describes, from the material, the physical, the vital, the mental, and then these other powers, potentialities, ways of seeing, ways of knowing. I think where I struggle is in the integration of all of that. I think that's part of why this work is so attractive, why Wilbur was so attractive as well, because he offered a framework with multiple lines of development and multiple levels of consciousness evolution. And I was surprised, and it was wonderful to find in this chapter some of those same exact ideas that Wilbur elaborates into his aqua theory, like the lines of development. And then what I essentially got here was this distinctness of the spiritual that I think became clear to me in a way that was not previous. And when I say became clear, I don't mean in the past. I mean that it's an unfolding appreciation that there is, what he's describing, I think, is true. In other words, this descent of the supramental into the mental and all of the other layers, that's happening. And so to understand that and to kind of to better perceive that landscape, I think is part of what I feel is called for by this text. And I think that's what you're pointing to with this list, because these are all features, these are all the things that one would expect to experience, or that would begin arising in experience in this ascent and descent process, in real experience, because that's the other thing that Aurobindo talks about here, is the difference between religious, spiritual thought, occult practice, and then actual experience. And the that's maybe taking it a step further, but for just an initial rapport resonancing, that's what I have.
Thank you very much. Can I ask you a question? In the interest of chunking down and chunking slow, is there, you've looked at this list, can you just pick out one?
Apprehending complex ideas all at once.
Okay, complex ideas all at once. And has that ever, have you ever had that experience?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's what I document in poetry. Partially, in addition to other things.
In poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Complex ideas all at once.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone have something different from this list that they are attracted to, or that they've had a robust experience of, or even curiosity about?
I may say, for example, self-healing. I just quickly went through the list. I didn't find it. Maybe I'm mistaken, but I think if self-healing would be one of the characteristic cities of the first touch of spirit in matter, I believe.
The first touch of spirit in matter and self-healing, and
not necessarily the only. Okay, not, but I think the earliest signs of spirit in matter, I think.
And have you had any experience of self-healing?
I believe so. Yes, something like that. Yes. But I think everyone can have this. It is, however, the problem is in our mind, not, you don't need to be a highly realized yogi but I think it is already there in our society. But we still are unaware of this effect. It's happening at the global scale, I believe. But people sometimes heal and they don't know why. Or maybe they believe it's to the doctor, but it's not.
Right.
And I think that we will see in the next future, the coming years, decades, more and more this effect, because I think it is happening what Sri Aurobindo says, that slowly but steadily humanity is going towards this stage of evolution.
Thank you. I'm also reminded of the placebo effect, which I think a lot of pharmaceutical companies in their research factor that in as something that's statistically provable, that there will be a certain amount of people, if you give them a sugar pill, they're going to get well just because they have a belief, a strong belief that they will. And also I would say, just a common everyday cold. Or, you cut yourself and you put a Band-Aid on it, and a few days later the cut is gone, but you don't know how that happened. So there are obvious self-healing that occurs, but there also can be healings that occur due to a deep intention and a relationship and a ritual. These are practiced worldwide in every culture.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a very important meta-capacity. So thank you for that. Is is there anyone else who would like to?
I think I have a very strong intuition, like stronger than average. So, you know, the Myers-Briggs types, one kind of cognitive mental capacity is intuition. And I think I'm very, very strong at that. I mean, I see patterns all the time and I see things connecting in an intuitive way, kind of from the inside out. And I can kind of see people like from the inside out, you know, emotionally and mentally, you know, kind of where they are just by kind of intuitively being present with them. Well, that's some kind of superpower right there.
And a strong intuition. And when did this strong intuition start? Do you remember?
You know, I have a theory how this personality types develop. I think that when I was very young, like just being around people and kind of maybe being like, I don't know, just being observing things and maybe being even like afraid and not wanting to figure out what happens around you. And if you don't have language, you use your intuition. And, you know, I think that's how it starts.
Thank you, Tony. Is there anyone else?
Yeah. Yeah, I also feel like my whole life I've been pretty, I don't know, in tune with my intuition, I guess I could say. My mom always used to say that I have a charmed life because things I want would just happen for me. Like we'd go into a store and when I was really little, you know, I'd be like, oh, I want that. My mom's like, no, we can't have that. And then the lady comes out, she's like, here, you want this, little girl? You know, I mean, that's like, whatever. But it got to other things where it would be like, I'm on the bus home from school at UC Santa Cruz and I see my friends on their bikes, like riding up the hill, and I get off and I'm like, oh, well, that'd be cool if they turned around and I got to hang out with them. And I just kind of let the thought go, like whatever. And then a minute later I turn around and there they are. And I'm like, did I create this? Did I, you know, intuit it happening? Both maybe are happening at the same time. Like the first time I went to UC Santa Cruz just to check out the campus, and I was still a junior in high school and I hadn't even applied to schools yet, but I was going to look at a few different schools, and we got up to this one spot, which is called Merrill College, and it has this really beautiful lookout from it, and you can see the ocean, and you can see all of Santa Cruz and the Monterey Bay. My friend and I, we just went straight there, like it was like we were being guided out to this lookout. I stood there and I just like took this deep breath in and had this really present moment with my surroundings and myself. And I felt suddenly like I leapt out of my body, but I wasn't completely out of my body either. It was like the boundaries diffused and I was like one with everything around me. And this very strong intuitive voice that I try to always listen to was like, you're going to be here for the next 4 or 5 years or more. And I just knew right then. I was like, okay, well, I'm getting into this school. I don't really even need to apply to other schools because this is where I'm going. And my dad got really mad at me. He's like, you don't know you're getting into that school. You know, you have to apply to other schools as a backup. I'm like, well, it's your money that you're wasting on the applications then, because I know where I'm going. And of course, that was the one school, the UC system, that I got into. So it's just things like that that have happened that really make me think like it's both are happening. Like this, it's like the evolution and the involution, like Aurobindo talks about, you know, like this ability to be present with that happening, because it's happening in every moment. And if we're not present to it, if we're like, you know, busy doing other things, then we can get just so caught up in those things and end up like, I know for myself, I've ended up in some pretty crazy, scary situations and later looked back and been like, wow, I wasn't listening to my intuition. Like I was just letting this thing happen to me. And when I realized like whatever, how many months or so I was in that period of my life or different times that this has happened, I remember looking back and thinking like, wow, none of these synchronistic experiences have been happening in this time. I've been so like caught up in whatever was happening and it was creating this really negative like outcome, and nothing magical was happening in my life during those times. And the moment I snap out of it and I make the right choice to listen to my intuition and get out of that situation that I was in, it's like suddenly the synchronicities just start like boom, 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 boom happening again. And because I'm paying attention, you know, it's like when I was able to serve a restraining order on my ex, and the moment I heard that the service had been done, I was on the phone with the lady telling me that she had served him. And right at that moment, my friend's like, look, look, a whale.
Wow.
Whale come up just as she's telling me he'd been served, and it just felt like this affirmation, like, okay, I'm on the right path again, like the universe is helping me, like every step of the way I've just been getting these like confirmations that I'm on the right path now. And that feels so good, because it's like I said, it's about this like evolution and involution, and like I don't know, being present with that. We are really powerful beings and we don't really even know it.
You mentioned the Santa Cruz landscape, the campus. I was there a number of years ago for a conference. I took a course, and I remember I was on this, it was a jogging path, and it was in this lot of high hills, and I saw a sign, and it said something about mountain lions, and if you see a mountain lion, don't run. It said you're supposed to wave, get really large as you can and start making noises like this. And that will intimidate the lion and they won't, but if you run, they'll charge you. But I remember seeing that sign and feeling the atmosphere of Santa Cruz. And I realized I'm not in Manhattan anymore, that's for sure. I'm very fond of that experience because of course it's the field of the ecology movement really started in waves from with you had Bateson and Margaret Mead and a lot of great teachers there at the same time. So I'm very fond of that location, and it does have a tremendous spiritual presence. So thank you for sharing that. Is there anyone else who wants to share anything?
Say, I'll build off of Lauren there. It goes with what I wanted to say, that I communicate with flies, with insects, and they're kind of my, I think Castaneda calls it the reaffirmations from the world around you. So if I'm speaking with someone or reading a book even, the insect, doesn't have to be a fly, will land on a particular word, or on a good day, they'll be hanging out with me. Like I'm not going to swat a fly, but on a bad day when I'm not in tune, like Lauren was saying, there's going to be some dead flies laying around because I'm not in tune with the world around me. But it's my barometer in a way. I'm not sitting there having a conversation with the fly, but it's almost like God's fingertip pointing at a word, or it can be my muse at times, helping me to understand where I want to start with writing or reading or even a conversation or something like that. But that's at least for 10 or so years, it's been my barometer for determining where I situate within the reception of maybe divine revelation.
Doug, you reminded me when I was looking at the list, it said something about detecting the intention of an animal. And I recalled that anecdote that you told about the sparrow, mm-hmm. teaching the sparrow or having that contact with the sparrow. Do you remember that one?
Yes, I'll share it real quick since we're in a sharing mood.
Yeah, I'm very fond of that one.
But this was maybe 5 or 6 months ago, I'd been hiking in the woods and I just had this feeling I had entered into a different zone of some sort. I think it was after listening to one of the Weird Studies podcasts and they talked about the zone, which is this alternate realm that you enter into and you can sense it, but you can't really explain it. But I was just hanging out there, taking a walk in the woods, and I heard a sparrow, and I had mimicked its, I recognized it as a white-throated sparrow, and I had mimicked its call. Then I changed it up and the sparrow responded with the same call that I demonstrated to it. And at the same time, I received something from the sparrow as well. I can't explain it, but I do have some sort of animal intuition, but the insect level is more distant from, I guess, the human. So it seems more otherworldly in a way. It's not like the insect is not communicating with me. Like I feel maybe a cat or a dog would be more eye to eye. The insect is more, there's some sort of distance, but there's still some strong connection.
Thank you, Doug. And thank all of you for sharing all of your learnings with us. I think it's clear that the metanormal capacities are, you know, kind of ordinary. It's not like a big deal. We all are can be more sensitive to them when they arise, and by paying attention to them and sharing them, I think we bring them into a communal space that makes them more than just an odd or totally relative subjective experience, because it becomes a communal experience. And I believe we'll be moving forward into the apperspectival that Aurobindo is trying to capture, so that we can. So I think this isn't just something that happens to highly adept yogis in caves somewhere. So thank you all for this opportunity to share. And I'm open to any observations anyone wants to make about this chapter. I mean, there are passages that I really, that jumped out at me, and I marked them. But I think both of these chapters have something similar, because he's looking at it from many different angles. And I believe it gets a little bit choppy in places and a little turbulent, and then he sort of smooths it out. But for me, there are passages that are quite resonant and very beautiful, but there's a lot of it that's very ambiguous. That's why I felt it helps me to ground in a kind of personal experience, like a robust first-person experience, like everyone's offered here, to help me enter into the weave of this narrative that Aurobindo is creating for us. So thank you.
I thought we were reading only one chapter.
Oh, I read two. We only have maybe...
It's chapter 24. The development of the spiritual man.
Yeah.
Die Entwicklung des spirituellen Menschen.
And the triple transformation?
No, only one.
Oh, well, I read both of them. Okay, so I can play hooky.
I will take up the next chapter next week.
Okay, great.
I wanted to say to Douglas, I on that fly story, I very much remember, when I was like, 10 to 15 years or so, I was an altar boy, you know, ministrant, so those, I don't know, those kids who do all the stuff in the church. And I had a priest who taught me something like, you know, the older you get, the longer you think about if you should kill a fly, you know. And I thought, oh, yes, okay. There's something about that, right? So if you're like very young, you just smash the fly, and the older you get and the more reflective you get, you think, oh, God. Now I know what I mean. Better not. So there's something about that.
When was the last time you killed a fly, Tony?
God, I killed a lot of mosquitoes today.
So we'll let you pass. You're okay with us?
That's a tricky one, you know? It's like with my son, I'm trying to teach him to like be nonviolent and all that, and then he sees us swatting flies inside the house. And so I have to like make this distinction. I feel like it helps at least for me to be like, no, honey, and if they're inside the house, some bugs like eat our clothes, or they might make our food bad because they land on it and they're dirty. And, you know, there's certain times when it's maybe okay to do that. But if they're outside, like, always leave them alone. Let them be outside. That's their world. And so now he'll be like, bug go bye-bye, bug go back to mommy and daddy. You know, I'm like, yeah, it's going back to its family, you know? Like, just trying to teach him that awareness. I think it's so important. And it's like scary when you see kids who are smashing bugs, and like it's like a level of like sociopathology. And I think it's super important to be that kind of mindful, I think.
Anyways. I remember that transition. I remember I was the oldest, and I had three younger brothers, and so I had a lot of power, so I could boss them around and make them do things, because I was when my parents weren't there, I was the one who was always in charge. But I remember I used to do really mean things, you know, nothing dangerous or anything, but, and I don't know when the transition happened. I think I may have been around 8, somewhere between 6 and 7, around 8 years old, I think that moral sense of, oh, you should be kind to your brothers. And I became very fond of them all of a sudden, and extremely protective of them. And I became the older brother that, instead of bullying them, I got, you know, into lots of fights, protecting them from bullies. So I think that tendency has gotten stronger in me as I've gotten older, that I felt that need to protect people that or animals if they were vulnerable. That doesn't mean I'm free of all cruelty, because I do, you know, I do eat chicken and fish. So I guess we all have to figure out how we make the cut, you know, how we parse the situations that we're in and find what's you know, real and what's imaginary and what's moral. So thank you.
Yes, a lot of children are sociopaths.
I think every child is a sociopath till about 5 or 6 maybe. And then I think the moral sense starts to kick in, if they're lucky, if there's have some support for that.
Yes, they aren't socialized. You know, you know, to that point, I often, you know, okay, so, you know, Ken Wilber, he has this idea of the retro romantic. You can also apply this to children. I mean, we often think of children as kind of being like little angels, but they're not. They're like little monsters. And I think especially conservative people have this idea of, I mean, somewhere must be something, some heaven must be somewhere, you know. And those children, I mean, they look so innocent, and so that's where the innocence is. But I mean, that's all only on the outside, really. So that's very superficial, I think. I mean, children aren't innocent at all. I mean, it's, I don't know. I mean, maybe nature really made little babies and little children look super, super cute. But I mean, if they were adults, you know, you never would let them do the things they do, you know.
And I see where you're coming from with that. And like, I understand it to a degree, but I also feel like, I don't mean to sound weird, but like, how many of us here have a kid and who have experienced from birth them growing up? It's a different thing once you witness that, you know?
I think there are some parents here.
Like the most loving, sweet little boy. The only reason he's ever like hit another kid was because they hit him too. And he learned that as a reaction. But at the same time too, like we're, you know, the mental, I mean, the logical brain doesn't start developing until they're two, and it's not finished developing until we're 24. I mean, that's a really big thing to sit and think about. Like, that's a long 24 years to form our logical brain fully, and most of us don't have the best help doing it when we're young, or our parents, like, expect that we should be able to think logically and not be stuck in this emotional tantrum that we're in when we're only 2 years old and we just started having a mental, you know, logical brain. So the only way that a child knows how to express their, say, anger or frustration is to, you know, freak out because they don't have the words yet to use. They don't have the tools and the skills yet that we will help implant in them. But I think like deep down, there is this like purity there, and we only learn negative habits and to be mean and immoral and stuff. Like, it's something that I think, you know, a child doesn't know its strength. So like when I was a kid and I had a hamster and I was like, I don't even really remember this that well, but I remember wanting to try to help it poop. And I killed it because I didn't know any better. Like, it's not, and in my intention, it was that I wanted to help it. I was loving it. I was like giving it this aid, but little did I know that I was going to kill it. So I just feel like there is that innocence and there is that like purity and love. And if the love from the family is lacking, if the proper, you know, skills aren't taught, which are really hard to teach. Well, you have to be really like questioning yourself as a parent with everything you do and realizing that you're teaching your child something with everything you say and do and how you respond to a situation. If you get frustrated when your child's having a tantrum, they're just going to be able to see that that's an okay response to something like that. But, you know, we know that when we calm down, we're able to like meet them and empathize with them on what they're feeling in that moment, even if it's totally irrational, like waking up in the middle of the night, but I left my stuffed animal upstairs. I need it right now. You know, you're like, I understand. I miss your stuffed animal too. I wish it was here. Or maybe even just going up and getting it, you know, even though it seems irrational, like that kind of a response instead of you don't need it, like go back to sleep. It's such a better learned experience from a parent.
Yes, no, I think the first 10 years of life, the first 10 years of your relationship, so developmentally the first 10 years are probably the most important. You know, this, you know, there was this German Jewish pedagogic theologian, Erich Fromm, he had this concept of Elternliebe, you know, parental love, like, and it's also kind of a almost like a theological thing. I mean, in the Christian tradition, I mean, being a father and being a mother, it's also kind of an archetypal role you fulfill for the child. So at a certain age, the child builds those structures. It seeks out for some, you know, guidance, and you're not just, you know, being a mother is more than just being a person. You're kind of this door to the world for this child in the first 10 years of its life. So kind of this parental love, it's something I think it's super important for every human being to have, like, in the first 10 years or so of your life. And you can seek, if you had enough of that, you can seek for that then for the rest of your life if you got enough love as a child, I think.
Yeah. I think that the last couple of comments remind me that of Wilbur's making the distinction between the East and the West, and how Western psychology has paid a lot of attention to children and the development of children, morally and emotionally and intellectually. Whereas in the East, the psychology focused on the adult. And certainly in Aurobindo, you get a lot of the development of adults who have reached a very high level of development. So I believe that, I think it was Wilbur who brought this to my attention, and I believe that this is accurate in this text, because I'm missing childhood development. This isn't his focus at all. If you were around today, I'm sure he would have updated himself on Piaget and, you know, but I think that's important. But when he's talking about the vital and the mental, and how the mental can modulate the vital, and the mental then can become more susceptible to the subliminal and to the more spiritual aspects of one's nature, which is veiled many times, and then unveiled, and then it seems to be veiled again. I think there's a whole lot of complexity, and it's challenging for me to read and to integrate these kinds of experiences that he's describing. I'm wondering how we can do that in the brief lifetimes that we have. I mean, and I was reading something today that really struck me about, she's a mathematician, but she mentions the Papus problem she's talking about was formulated in antiquity, but could be solved only in the 17th century using Descartes' analytic geometry. She mentions Fermat's last theorem was formulated by Fermat in 1637, but solved only in 1995 by Andrew Wiles. So it's centuries sometimes before problems get resolved. I'm thinking of Oscar Wilde, who was imprisoned for sodomy for 3 years in hard labor, and he died shortly after he was released from prison. And then, you know, I guess it was 10 years ago, the sodomy laws in the United States were struck down. So I'm just pointing out how these are kind of intergenerational movements. And so I can understand why Aurobindo says there's no technique for self-realization. That it has to be sort of, and why he sort of seemed to stay away from techniques. Or there was no method. That is sort of each person is so individual and has different kinds of perhaps cracks and features in their personality, and different relationships to the vital, or the heart, or the or the mental. So I guess that's my quandary in reading this chapter. It seemed to be a little bit all over the place for me. And I didn't find, I felt like, but when I stopped trying to find an argument, what I did find was each paragraph seemed to be like the same paragraph. It seemed like there's the same motif. It sort of was in every paragraph. And sort of like each paragraph seemed to be like a theme with variations, rather than offering a kind of clear-cut argument. Or maybe there was an argument there, I just missed it. It was much more of a mosaic or collage to me. But I'm open to other points of view, for sure.
I personally think that in this paragraph, or chapter 24, I mean, this was just, I thought this was very, very juicy and very substantive. He very well described kind of the spiritual landscape and lined out his yoga there. And, you know, in the end of the chapter, he said something very similar that you mentioned, John, with the plurality, I think he said just at the last page, something like, in a sense of a spiritual pluralism, so there's the manyness in the one. So at the higher stage, we have a manyness, but the goal of this manyness is to reach a harmony in the manyness of the one. So that's the goal of his yoga. He recognizes the manyness and the kind of plurality of views and perspectives, but the goal of this integral yoga is to create a harmony in the one and the oneness, which recognizes the manyness of its expressions. You know, personally, you know, I read this chapter today. I thought this was just incredible. I mean, I thought this was very much pointing out to something transcendent. I, you know, I thought this chapter in particular was very. That's something I would pick up later on, maybe sometime later this next year or so, and just read this one chapter. I thought it was very. It brought out this kind of divine spark, I thought. So maybe we could talk a little bit more about this chapter in particular, because people have read it and they have probably something to say about it.
Yeah, it's an open frame. So anyone, feel free to chime in.
You know, on page 226 at the beginning, I made a few notes here. You know, I think what he points out is something that we can't escape. So most of our lives, we are escaping something. And there's the factual world, and there are just things that are in front of us, and we try to arrange life in a way that we get as much pleasure as possible without just looking at the world just as it is. And we're trapped in the mental, and there's this kind of, I don't know, existential perspective that you can take in just seeing through all the construction, all the, I don't know, running away or looking away, and just looking at life just as it is. And I think that's something that he tries to point out in his yoga.
Yeah, I also got, I'm just quoting, he's talking about occultism, early forms of occultism and magic and religion. And he says at some time, it must have dawned on him that he had something in him which was not physical, a soul that survived the body, certain supernormal experiences which became active because of the pressure to know the invisible, must have helped to formulate his first crude ideas of that entity within him. It would only be later that he began to realize that what he perceived in the action of the universe was also there in some form within him, and that in him also were elements that responded to invisible forces and powers for good or for evil. And a few pages later, he's continuing to pick up that motif and sort of he brings it back again in talking about hypnotism and trance states. He's talking about the modern admission of hypnotism is an example of a discovery and systematized application, but still narrow and limited by its method and formula, of occult powers, which otherwise touches only by casual or hidden action, whose process is unknown to us or imperfectly caught by a few. But we are all the time undergoing a battery of suggestions, thought suggestions, impulse suggestions, will suggestions, emotional and sensational suggestions, thought waves, life waves that come on us or into us from others or from the universal energy, but act and produce their effects without our knowledge. A systematized endeavor to know these movements and their law and possibilities, to master and use the power or nature force behind them or to protect ourselves from them, would fall within the province of occultism. But it would only be a small part, even of that province, for wide and multiple are the possible fields, uses, processes of this vast range of little explored knowledge. I think that in our time with the internet, And our modern world, all of those suggestions, are just, we're bombarded by them. And I believe it takes enormous vigilance to disentangle ourselves from the occult forces that are very much alive in on Wall Street and Madison Avenue and the Pentagon. They're using this occult stuff. So I think it's very important to be sensitive to going into a trance, and trance states are inevitable every day. The common ordinary trance, we space out and we have reveries and we use our imagination. Some of it's healthy, some of it's not. And I think there's a big difference between a high quality trance state and sitting in front of the TV or surfing the web. I think those are very low level trance states that can be very destructive.
I think prior to that, in that chapter, he lines out the development of human religions, starting at the animistic to the, pluralistic, then to the monotheistic, and so on, and to the institutionalization of belief, and then just belief in belief, and then the falling away of the kind of pre-rational animistic elements of just of the magical, and then people just doing the rituals and doing the beliefs and having the ethics without the spirituality, and then at the next stage, re-emergence of the spirituality, and then he brings something in like hypnosis, but I think in a way that is kind of transpersonal, so not the necessarily the magical occult, but an occult that, kind of is transpersonal, and maybe like in the construction of, in institutions and kind of, in a modern, postmodern world. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I have some thoughts on this chapter, beginning with, I think, what is the elephant in the room here in Aurobindo, but also in other integral thinkers. I have Jean Gebser on my mind right now because this weekend is the annual Jean Gebser Society conference, and it's taking place here in Colorado.
What?
Yeah.
I wish I could be there.
Oh, you could.
Well, no, I can't. But maybe next year.
Yeah, I don't know where. Marco's
going to be presenting there. Did you mention that?
Well, I'm going to be presenting with Heather Fester and Jeffrey Edwards. We're doing a panel discussion on Sunday. And on Saturday night, we're doing a poetry reading. And so Jeffrey, Heather will be there. Jeremy Johnson is going to be there as well. We reconnected a few other people, folks from the conference. And so I'm kind of excited.
Can you like send an email about like a link to the information about the conference? So I remember it.
Yeah, sure. I'll share. Yeah.
You'll be posting the videos too, I hope.
Hopefully.
So I would love to watch.
Yeah. We're definitely going to record the poetry, and the other stuff should be recorded as well. They don't have a big budget. Let's put it that way. That's happening, and I've been thinking a lot about Gebser, and I noticed that many of the aspects of this chapter map really well with Gebser. But I brought up the mental and the material because I think it's the elephant in the room. It's what Gebser spends well over half of Ever-Present Origin disentangling from, like differentiating what he's talking about. He wants to talk about the integral, but he doesn't want it to be confused with the mental. And I think Aurobindo is in the same place here. And the thing that is so moving to me about this text is that it really just flips that whole elephant on its head, if you will. Not to be unkind to the elephant. But what I understand him saying, which is similar to what Gebser was saying, is that there's something going, what's going on now in reality? What's going on now historically? And as this drama of human evolution, it's fundamentally about origin, what Gebser calls origin, or what Aurobindo calls, you know, God, spirit, the absolute, the secret spiritual entity. It's fundamentally about that coming into the world in this fullness, right? It's like the involution of that and the evolution of it into forms. And that's always been what it's been about, is what I understand him to be saying. Like from the beginning, there was this secret spiritual entity, the self, the spirit, the infinite, there in matter, and then there in life, and then there in mind, except at each stage, you know, because of the limitations of the particular substance, that truth, you know, that core truth, that reality isn't recognized. So there's a witness, but it's like mistaking. That's the ignorance. But what's happening in the evolution of the spiritual man is that the spiritual essence is coming to awareness of itself as itself, as Hegel would say. And it's doing that in the context of embedded in the material and the psychic and the mental and everything, all the different gradations. But that's what it's about. That's what I think is, it's not like the argument here is that these are not epiphenomena of the main, you know, the material substrate. That the material substrate is actually an epiphenomena or an effect of the spiritual substance of you know, who and what we are. And so then he gives these three, like he describes what that means. It means direct spiritual experience. It can't be like you can translate it into mental terms or into mythic terms or into magic terms, but what it actually is, the experience of origin or the experience of spirit, is a direct thing. It's an immediate thing. It's a knowledge by identity, not by description or contact or creating a model of it. It's the thing itself. And so he then talks about the qualities of that, what that's like, but then how do we get there? Well, then there are these four ways. Like one is the occult arts, which is the magic in Gebser. Two is religion, which I think in this text is the mythic. And then three is spiritual philosophy, which is the mental. And all of those are important. They all work out potentialities of being, but they're not the thing itself. So the fourth thing is the thing itself, and that's the direct spiritual experience, which manifests in all of these types of cities and powers. And this is what we're starting to bring online, as Jeff Salzman says. And so I think that's where he ends in with that, though, is that you have this radical pluralism, because that experience is as unique as every individual soul. And so whatever the limitations that the mental would put on it, or the mythic would put on it, or the magical kind of preoccupation with, when it's merely a preoccupation with the powers and the, which, by the way, I think that's what he says becomes science, actually. Like, that becomes alchemy and science. Those become less important. They're supportive of, but they're not used as a substitute for the thing itself, the actual experience. And I think that's what's, that's what this is about. Like, so what are we all working on here? Aurobindo would say we're working on bringing the supramental into manifest existence, into our bodies, into our world, into our relationships, into everything. And the part in this chapter where I get a little, I bring a little bit of a more critical perspective is the way that he situates the hierarchy. This is very hierarchical. There's one passage here I'll share. So he's describing what happens when the witness, basically comes into its full fluorescence, fully manifests. But if after several ages or cycles, the witness had looked again and seen this miracle in full process, even then perhaps obscured by his original experience of the sole reality of matter in the universe, he would still not have understood. It would still seem, so he's describing the ignorance at this point, but the passage I want to get to is coming up right now, the sentence. It would still seem impossible to him that the hidden spirit could wholly emerge, complete in its consciousness, and dwell upon the earth as the self-knower and the world-knower, nature's ruler and possessor. Impossible, he might say. All that has happened is nothing much, a little bubbling of sensitive gray stuff of brain, a queer freak in a bit of inanimate matter moving about on a small dot in the universe. This is like when he's being funny. But this, like, what he's pointing to is that he's seeing that spirit, supramental, establishes its own dominion, essentially. Like, the way that the mental has a dominion over the earth, kind of encircling it in technology and in systems and processes, the supramental has its own dominion and has this downward sort of causative, like, almost control over mind, nature, the body, etc. And I wonder if there's a kind of remnant or a vestige of the colonizer sort of mentality, the colonialist mentality, with the ruler and the sort of monarch who imposes the superior consciousness on the lower, the inferior. I wonder if that's recapitulating itself in here, and if a more postmodern interpretation would look more of a partnership between, the different levels of being, more of a partnership between the, the consciousness or the spirit and the nature, the different, aspects. I think that's more probably where we are culturally now. But there's just a tremendous verticality here, and that's important as well. And so I would see the integral being more of a blend of the vertical aspiration and also the proper appreciation of the truth, the greater truth value of spirit vis-a-vis mind and the lower structures of consciousness. But that you know, it wouldn't be such a such a just radically hierarchical kind of masculine type of style, I think. So, but that's, I mean, this is part of what he points out, is that there's a certain necessity too to even the asceticism and to the extremer points of view, because they kind of clear possibilities out. You know, they kind of clear space.
Could it be said that the nihilism that he observes may be necessary also for the development?
It goes beyond nihilism.
But you have to have nihilism to go beyond it.
Yes, yes, I totally agree.
So I think
if you don't see the problem, you can't go beyond it.
I think a danger we are, I think if we suppress our nihilism with drugs, sex, rock and roll, and shopping, you know, it's rather than just deal with what's underneath all of that is, you know, the angst and the loneliness and, you know, you just don't want to do this anymore. And I think that's part of that postmodern wave that I think that Banerjee was very sensitive to, that he believed if Aurobindo were around, he would be very sensitive in a way that doesn't come across in this text, which is, I would say, masculinist and very, very sort of dogmatically hierarchical. But he's also dealing mostly with the individual. And I believe that's something that is the postmodern brings forward, I think, the communal nature of our evolution, that no man or woman is an island. And before we can be individuals, our individuality emerges out of relationships that value individuality. Children don't learn to be individuals unless they have adults around them who think that's important. And that's where I do think Wilbur is correct in trying to supplement the Eastern traditions, which are tremendously rich, but they're working more with an adult and a successful adult at that. Mm-hmm. I think these are already adults that he's describing with a lot going for them. but I wonder how many adults are in such a privileged position in our particular late stage capitalist culture. And I'm not trying to say thumbs down on capitalism. I think there's some virtues that capitalism has instilled in all of us, and modernism is great. But I think the postmodern wave has been a lot about looking at the downside of the modern. And I don't think he's done that yet. I think he probably would have if he'd lived another couple of decades. He didn't see the civil rights movement. And he only saw just the beginning of, you know, the British Crown leaving. And that was when the partition between Pakistan and India, which has proven to be a disaster, really, in some ways. I'm not faulting him for not seeing everything about our future in a pristine and clear way, because there are some things that he was mapping out, I think, extremely accurately. But I think he's left out that network, the vibrant networks that we are all of us are enmeshed in and entangled in to some extent. And some of that entanglement might be perfectly healthy, and some of it might be very dysfunctional. So we have to sort of figure that out on our own and together, you know.
Did Gebze knew of Aurobindo? Was he influenced by him?
I think he did know him at the end of his life. I think he became familiar with Aurobindo's teachings. Am I right about that? I'm not sure, but
yes, he had already kind of come up with his idea, and then he came across Aurobindo. He writes about it in the preface, I believe, to Ever Present Origin, and points to Aurobindo as well as Teilhard de Chardin as a kind of corroboration for what he was proposing. Because he was still trying to demonstrate trying to establish a pattern. Like, this is a set of phenomena that's distinct from, you know, what you know we think is modern or whatever. There's something different happening here, and so he saw Aurobindo as a further example of that.
So how much would you say, Marco, are those both compatible with each other?
I think they're completely compatible. I think that Gebser brings some interesting different terms or concepts to this, and particularly with this idea of mutation, the mutation of consciousness, the way that he sees that happening, not so hierarchically in the way that Aurobindo does. Although even Aurobindo allows that, like, I think the idea of mutation would fit perfectly with Aurobindo, because when he describes how consciousness evolves, he sees it happening in all kinds of different ways and many different, you know, occult pathways, you know, various eddies and, you know, mazes that it has to go through, and ways that it gets lost, and ways that it forgets what it was supposed to be doing, and then has to remember itself. I mean, it's a tremendous, it's a vast, complex, multifarious, living, you know, teeming process, as Aurobindo describes it. And I think that that fits very well with Gebser's idea, because he sees mutations kind of popping up historically. And then those mutations, as there are enough of them, or as they kind of form a pattern, begin to shape the world, essentially, begin to shape the world to sustain themselves. So an integral world would sustain integral consciousness in the same way that a mental rational world sustains mental rational consciousness. So in a mental rational world, children are taught to be individuals. And they're taught to identify with their mind and taught to construct themselves in a certain way that conforms with that structure. But an integral or supramental world would be very different than that. And what both Aurobindo and Gebser and Chardin and Wilbur, what they're all, I think, saying is that this is what's happening historically, is that this new structure of consciousness, this new transparency, is how Gebser puts it, realization or evolution, spiritual evolution, like that's happening, and that's trying to happen. And part of the tumult that we're experiencing is the breakdown of the mental structures as the integral attempts to establish itself. I think that's what's happening. And Gebser, you know, Aurobindo is a lot more confident about that happening than Gebser is. Gebser is like, it's 50-50. You know, it could either all go to shit, or, you know, we can have this kind of mutation on a mass scale.
I think he said, and I think he wrote this in 1950, The Ever-Present Origin. Mm-hmm. He said it'll either happen in the next 50 years or in the next 2,000 years. So I think the 50-year mark is up. We've already passed it. And so I guess we could interpret this in many different ways. On good days, I see astonishing things happening. And I'm just saying, wow. And then there are other days I think, wow, this is so far away. It's just a total fantasy. And might as well go get a job on Wall Street, make a lot of money and forget about all this integration. But, you know, then, so I'm very aware of my own vital body and how attracted I can be to these kind of, the you know, the gaudy things that are being offered to me all over the place, because I live in a big city, which is, you know. And I'm sure we also have those temptations to drop all this spiritual work. No one's going to give us a Nobel Peace Prize or an Academy Award or anything terribly lucrative, because we do all of this work. So I think these communal efforts that we're making here online are extremely nourishing, because probably most of us have to work on our own and try to keep the flame, the spark alive as best we can. So I think these adventures in consciousness can really be very nurturing if we can find a communal space so that we can articulate these experiences. And there's a self-correction that happens in that process if you have a community of the adequate. But if you don't have such a community, you can have incredibly enlightening experiences and they go nowhere. It's just like a firework display. And so I think there is something about to concretize this. I think that's the language Gebser would use. Mm-hmm. Or to manifest, as I think Aurobindo would say, is very tricky. But I do think you're right. I think Gebser was less optimistic than Aurobindo, and for good reason. I think he went through the First and Second World Wars, and he was in the middle of the Cold War, had just sort of kicked off. And that looked like a pretty dark period. So anyway.
I think he also didn't have as sophisticated a contemplative practice as Aurobindo did. I mean, Aurobindo had all these yoga, you know, teachings to draw from. He had the whole history of Hinduism, Vedanta, Indian religion. And Gebser was looking to reconstruct those, rediscover those currents from in the West, as well as in global civilizations. But I don't think he had a yoga in the way that Aurobindo did. So, nor, as you've pointed out many times, the ashram, you know, where he could fully develop that, the integral, like at least in himself, in the way that I think Aurobindo does, and so can speak from with a lot of confidence. So I think Gebser in a way is culturally closer to us and he better reflects our experience. But Aurobindo gives some greater, I think, hope for the future than I would just get from Gebser alone.
What do you think would Gebser think about this higher aspirations beyond the integral? So I think this is not very much present in Gebser. Also, I think in Gebser, it's more of a bottom-up model, while in Aurobindo, it's like involution, evolution. And there's also a top-down. There's a kind of, you know, from the outside and from the, I don't know, from the Satchitananda and from the supermind, which kind of goes between the Satchitananda and kind of this world. You know, I think there's more of an top-down in Aurobindo. And what do you think would Gebser think of basically everything that goes beyond what he called the integral?
I don't know what Gebser would think. I don't think he was thinking in terms of beyond the integral. I don't think he really thought beyond that. In the way Wilbur has super integral.
He ended up at its integral. And the integral was the highest for him, right?
But he didn't think of it as highest either. So this is why this is why Gebser is interesting, because so like, you say origin.
I haven't read. Sorry, I really don't want to interrupt you. I haven't read Gebser. I think, you know, I hadn't the time, but I watched the YouTubes. And so from what I gathered, it's more like it's just like interwoven. You have all those structures there at the same time. So there's this like 2018, right? So we have this green structure. It has some pattern that started somewhere in history. And then we have this other structures and they are all there. We can access those at any time. And it's just added. It's not like you go from one to the next, but it's all there at the same time. And it's integral. It's kind of this aperspectival, like an awareness.
You're reading Gebser through Wilbur.
Yes. That's what, I never read Gebser, so I don't know. But I think that he had nothing that went beyond the integral. Gebser and Aurobindo does have something. I also think that what Gebser calls the integral is not what Aurobindo called the integral. For Aurobindo, the integral is an integration of different traditions. It's, you know, seeing through like everything that's there, and then integrating those in, basically aligning those views into one thing. And that's what's the integral for out of window, I think.
I would disagree with that. I think that that's sometimes how Wilbur's integral is constructed or articulated, but I'm not saying that that's his total view either. But there are passages in Life Divine where Aurobindo talks about the supreme Satchidananda as the integral, as the supreme integral reality. Or, you know, he has many different, very poetic and grand ways of talking about that. But Gebser, this notion of origin, is interesting because origin isn't up there. It's not higher exactly. It's maybe more, if I think of feel origin, I feel it's more lower. And I think Gebser is more bottom up. I think you're right. But for Gebser, the integral is, it is origin. And it's the transparency of consciousness to itself as origin. So in that sense, I think even though he kind of gives you a bit of it in the way that it's not as full blown as Aurobindo, I think it's the same thing. And I just don't think it's as fully developed, as fully articulated, like all the petals of the flower that Aurobindo gives when he talks about, you know, the supreme being. Gebser doesn't do that. He's still like, you know, just barely getting beyond the mental. So I think he's really worth reading. I think you would love reading Gebser. And we did all the talks on him, and many resources to help with that. I think Gebser adds something really, really, really useful and really good to the whole integral mix.
They once asked Sri Aurobindo in what sense his yoga differs from other yogas. And what he said is that the substantial difference is that this integral yoga is meant for a transformation of the whole humanity, not only of the individual. Whereas usually other yogas are focused on the development of the individual, where in his vision, we are going towards a transformation of whole society and towards a new being. And I think this is one aspect of in what sense he means integral. The other thing about integral, what I think as I read him also, is that he meant that everything in us must be transformed, corresponding to must be this divine transmutation, but not only of the mind, and whereby you go into some nirvana and that's it. This is also an important step, but we should not step there. And the aim is the transformation of all our planes and parts of our being, which means the vital, the mental, and lastly also the physical. And this on a collective scale, not just for the salvation of someone, some individual who leaves then the terrestrial existence and doesn't return back, so to speak. That's how I understand the word integral in Sri Aurobindo. And if I may say also about the idea of the hierarchies. Yes, it's true that in Sri Aurobindo there are, it's very hierarchical. So I can't speak this word. There's this ladder of states of consciousness. But I don't think he's giving it, even if sometimes maybe someone might read him in this way, but I don't think that he's making a moral judgment, that he's saying this is bad or this is good, and this is, he sees that as a step of evolution from ignorance, unconsciousness, subconsciousness to higher states of consciousness. When we are more conscious, this means higher in so to speak. But there is no moral judgment. And by the way, he once said also that a human being, even if he places the human being, so to speak, on a higher rung of the ladder compared to animals, for example, there are many instances where he says that the human being is the most perverted being that has manifested on the terrestrial scene, because mind can be used, is a double sword power. It can be used for good things, but also for evil things. And this is an aspect that is particularly strong in the human being. So in this sense, there was quite a negative view, I would say, of mind and the human being. And if you read Sri Aurobindo, he's severely critical of everything that has to be with the mental plane. Because we live fully in this mentalized society. And of course, we are much more aware also of its negative side effects. And I don't think, therefore, that he places mind on a higher level than others in a moral sense. Mind is de facto a power that you don't find in a vital world or in a just unconscious material world of the stone. In this sense, it is superior. But the main message of Sri Aurobindo is to go much more beyond that. And that's, I think, characteristic. Whereas we still are strongly, I think even in the last years, in the last decade, I would say, this mental grip in our society has become even stronger. And I hope it is the side effect, so to speak, of something more spiritual and more inward that is manifesting, and it is resistance that is becoming stronger. I hope that that's the right interpretation. Otherwise, it would be a real problem in the next years, I think.
Well, I think there's a problem I have. Well, I'm thinking about William Irwin Thompson, who's another integral thinker who isn't mentioned much by Wilberians because he was very critical of Wilber, and what he considered Wilber's misreadings of Gebser, for instance. But William, he's the one who said that he thought Aurobindo and the mother represented post-religious spirituality, that they were breaking out of the traditional tantric consort kind of thing. They were already middle-aged people, so it just wouldn't fit, you know, this highly sexed power couple. With the mother and Aurobindo are not that, for sure. And so they were already, they were drawing upon that tradition, but they were playing out some variations on it that I think look very like power sharing between equals. And in a way, though, he was sort of the absentee father. He went off and meditated and let the mother take care of the ashram and make it functional. But I don't think that that's going to work particularly well for us. I think he did privilege the idea that the spiritual path has many perils, and he's very creative at describing those perils. But I don't think the remedy that he proposes is at all probable, because he thought you need a guru, you need a teacher, you need someone to take you by the hand and lead you, who's gone through this and who can lead you through it. I just doubt that seriously is going to be workable, especially as we've had one wave after another of abuse, scandals, spiritual teachers abusing their students and their power and money as well. So I think that whole notion of that kind of privileged relationship, that guru relationship is workable. But I do think small groups who are dedicated and who make a commitment to sponsor one another, as many of us are trying to do here, I think that the there's a benefit to that. I think we can hold these energies in ways that support us rather than contribute to our fragmentation and distractions. Because I do think the pitfalls are still there, even amplified more in the life worlds that we're participating in. But I just don't think the solution is going to be a guru or a teacher who's been through it before, because we're all too unique. We have the burden of our uniqueness, and there's no one who's going to understand me better than I understand myself. You can certainly give me some insights and share some points of view. And the more points of view I have in a group that's competent, the better I benefit from that. But I think that is workable in a way that a guru figure or a guru power couple just is not. But that's my response, having been through so many cultish situations and seen the damage that's done.
The only thing that I feel like comes up right away when you're speaking there, at least this last thought that came to me, it's like, that you said this guru power couples, and I agree with pretty much everything you're saying there. But it made me think, like, to my own desires as a child to like be some sort of martyr almost, like for helping to like save the world. And then I realized it's not like about saving the world. It's that it's more of like, how can I help the world? Like one of the mantras I have is like, I am in the world to change the world. And that's by leading by example. And I don't want anyone to follow me and think of me as a guru or anything, but I want to be able to be that example for the world. And with my choices and actions, be that change that I want to see. Because I can't change other people. You know, they have to be willing to change. If they want to learn from me, if they're willing to come to me and ask me, how did you do it? What are your experiences? I'm more than happy to share that, you know? But just like recognizing that, yeah, that guru thing, like nobody should be worshiping anyone. It's about finding it within yourself and sharing that with the world and seeing that we're all equal. Like that's something that I got. I think Gemser is like easier to follow for me reading him. Aurobindo kind of keeps like spiraling in and out of ideas, and I have a hard time following him always. But I like how Gebser describes like the stages of it. The stages of it, like not that it helped me in being able to look back and like empathize with people who I would have normally like completely disagreed with and thought were like crazy bigots or like conservative people who were just backwards in their thinking, you know. But it really allowed me to like empathize with people and see that we are all one, and yet each one of us is like awakened to a certain degree, maybe, and you know, some people are more stuck in their like mythic consciousness and are really focused on their religious ideas and all that, and I can like empathize with that instead of seeing myself as like better than that. And again, it's more of like being that change, showing that empathy. Like time, I don't know if I shared this story with you guys once, but I'd lost my keys at a music festival up in the High Sierras, and I had to get home somehow, and I met somebody who had the like gold AAA and was able to get me a free AAA ride all the way down towards Sacramento. It was a long ride, and everyone's like, good luck, you're in the hills, you're gonna have some hillbilly tow truck driver for like 2 hours. Good luck, you know? And I got in the car and I let down any preconceived notions I may have had, and we had the most incredible conversations about how we used different words to describe it. He used the word God, you know. I talked about like spirit or consciousness, and we were talking about how you can find that in nature. And he has to like show me these two incredible spots along the highway where there's like these hidden views of waterfalls and stuff. And he takes me out and he just stands there and like, he's taking these deep breaths in, and I'm just like, wow, here's this guy who's like, you know, a Jesus lover and probably has a lot of other like differing views than I, but we could connect on something that was like so pure and really a beautiful experience. Our conversations were all over the place, and I left the whole thing giving him a hug and being so grateful, you know, to have had that interaction. So it's about being the change we want to see and not following any one person, but being open to others and asking questions. And...
You know, Lauren, you know, in the words of self-help literature, there's a common theme that pretty much goes as follows. People overestimate their capacity to change the whole world and change society and change everything, and they underestimate their capacity to change themselves. So your power, I mean, you can change your life, and you have much more power and much more influence and changing yourself, changing your life, than changing other people and changing society as a whole. And that's where your power lies. And I think that, I mean, you can do things around your family, around your, you know, your influence lies, you know, pretty much around you. So there are probably people, I don't know, in your wider family, your cousins and your aunts or whatever. I mean, you probably don't know them very well. Maybe someone sits in a hospital somewhere and you don't know. I mean, it's kind of the same with me. I don't know, you know, my wider family. I don't know a lot of people very well. So I just get the message from someone that he's kind of in a hospital or something, and I haven't seen this guy for a year or so. And, you know, it's very interesting. I mean, we want to change the world, but we don't even know about the people in our close environment. And you don't have to go to Africa or to some distant place to help people.
So I wanted to go back to kind of the hierarchical stage. We were talking about kind of the guru or the master. And I'm not familiar with Hegel all too much, but The master-slave dynamic has always appealed to me, and I feel like a lot of that's going on in this chapter, to the point, or like when Marco Morelli mentioned, like, the nature is subordinate to, at the beginning in the narrative that Aurobindo has, he kind of goes through these stages of the witnessing, and then if that witness just witnessed a little bit more, there'd be a little bit more understanding. But in a way, right now, at least, I'm viewing this supermind or Satchitananda as the master. At points, it seems like that's Aurobindo's focus, and we are, in a sense, the slaves too. It's beaming down its power, and we're essentially marionettes, just moving about at its will, moving around where it needs us to go. But if I'm reading the master-slave dynamic carefully, the slave eventually realizes that it is integral to the master's existence. The master needs me, the slave, to continue on. So now I have this idea in my head, and I can become I'm aware of that. So now I know that the master is not all powerful. It needs me in the process. But this can be seen as our daily mental activity, our master mental mind trying to kind of shun away the occult or whatever practices we try to do, and just continue on with our daily life. But then once we get past that master-slave dynamic, there's the cohesive relationship between the two. Maybe the master will fight back for a while, or the slaves will revolt, but then realize that the revolution isn't really, they didn't have a plan afterwards, so they need to turn back to some sort of mastery.
But who is a master and who is a slave in this idea, this narrative?
I guess that's kind of the point. At some point in the realizations that there will be no master, there will be no slave. There's no guru. But essentially, I guess at the beginning, Hegel is pointing out that there's that limited archetypical master and the archetypical slave. But then as the story progresses, there's so many layers upon layers that eventually everything or everyone kind of comes together in some sort of cohesion. But I'm probably skewing the whole thing now.
It's kind of like this idea in Aurobindo that everything that can be done has been done as part of a dialectic, like all of the different types of spiritual practices have been kind of established in order that something else then arises out of that. And those steps had to be done in order that something higher could emerge, just like the slave has to be a slave at some point to become a master. And that's also part of the dialectic.
Yes, but... go ahead.
All right, well, we discussed a story, a short story that Doug introduced last week or 2 weeks ago by Octavia Butler. It's called The Book of Martha. And in this short story, the character, her name is Martha, she's, up making tea or something like that. And she gets transported into this space where she's in a conversation with God. And she has this conversation a few different times, and it kind of changes each time. But the form that God takes in the conversation changes. At first, it's this huge, like, statuesque white male patriarch, who very well could be a master. And she, of course, could very well be the slave. And as the conversation progresses and she gains insight, the form changes and ultimately becomes a black man, becomes a black woman. And we speculated it could keep changing. It could become an amoeba or a fly or a sunset, like the form of God could keep changing. And so the master slave is just this one pattern, but it doesn't have to be that way. So that's what I felt like that story was one way of expressing. And I think that's kind of what you're saying here, that like it could transform, and certainly has to transform, because it's a brutal arrangement. Even if it may be like, you know, I don't know if it's necessary actually. I mean, historically it happened in real life, but that doesn't mean it's necessary.
But I think in most cases, there is not this master-slave relationship in the sense that someone is a master and I am the slave. But in the most cases, we are slaves of ourselves. And that's what also all, I think, this yoga is about. It is a method of transcendence, but it's not particular to this yoga. It's you can find it, and not only particular to yoga. It's, I think, something, a spiritual exercise and development that is quite a common theme, that we have to learn to find ourselves being slaves of ourselves. Sometimes we keep ourselves in a prison and have thrown away the key. Yeah, that's the real issue, I think. It's not so much about being free from or guru thing. Also the guru, I mean, yes, it's okay if someone feels fine with a guru, I have nothing against it. But I think also in the narrative or in the idea of Sri Aurobindo, I don't find him so frequently saying that it is needed, that there is someone needs necessarily a guru. He says in some occasions he has said something like that, yes. But I think he was speaking to his ashramites in the ashram. And I don't find this emphasis in Sri Aurobindo. And what he tells much more is that we have to find the guru in ourselves. And he doesn't put it in these terms, but at bottom, it is about the discovery of the psychic being. Psychic awakening of the psychic being is nothing else than finding your guru in yourself. So in this sense, I think we will never be able to do it, to go to develop ourselves without a guru in this sense, because everything is a guru. Also, what I experience in my everyday life, I come at home in the evening, I think, this happened, what did I learn? Sometimes a lot of things. So life is a guru. You have an inner guru. It's not necessarily someone in a person that we must think as in this sense. And that's a quite common theme, I think, in Sri Aurobindo. And it is also true that it makes not much sense to try to convert others if we are not willing to convert to, so to speak, ourselves. It's quite clear for me, at least.
Well, I agree, Marco. I had a very, for a brief while, I was very close friends with a man who died of AIDS. This is back in the 80s. And he was a cowboy type. He was raised on a farm in Nevada. But I remember him talking, and I knew him in New York, and he said what he really wanted to do, or who he thought about the most, it's not the spiritual experiences, you know, or the gurus or the great artistic things he'd seen, but he was thinking about the little lady in that little town in Nevada who ran the post office. You know, he remembered the grocer. He remembered he had a friend who was an Indian, and they used to, as little boys, you know, they played cowboys and Indians. But he had those are the kind of things that seem to have a kind of radiance about those experiences or an aura around them. So I always remembered that, that the guru is, you know, works at the farmer's market, you know, or the Barnes and Noble, or the clerk who, you know, gives you something extra that they didn't have to give you, or the barista who gives you an extra cup of coffee. You know, so those little gestures of kindness and love, I think, are the ones that are very, very important, rather than the great climaxes, you know, the kundalini explosions and things like that, which I had plenty of. So I also remember that Roy Bhaskar said that master relies on the creativity of the slaves. So I think the slave has to figure that out, that I'm the creative principle here, not the master. And then when the slaves wake up to that and are ready to live without that master-slave dynamic, then that dynamic will change. And I think, I don't know much about Hegel, but I think the idea that spirit will always take us by surprise. All of our well-laid plans, all of our theories about everything, it could be global warming, maybe bringing forward spiritual capacities that would have been dormant. So I certainly don't want to go through another hurricane, but there have been, I think our friend Jeremy is in Florida in a hurricane right now. So I hope he can make it to the Gebser. I know he's the president of the Gebser Society. So I hope he is able to travel safely. So I'm just saying that even the most catastrophic events in our lives, which we do not enjoy and would wish on no one, can actually be a catalyst for the spirit, because we learn things that we didn't want to learn, but once we learned them, we can never forget, and we can't go back to where we were, which is sometimes in a half sleep. So thanks.
I read the last 100 pages of the Phenomenology about 2 weeks ago. You know, in Hegel, when he goes into the religion, so up to that point, he builds up, and in the last 100 pages, he talks about this dialectical development of the religion, and then he goes into the absolute spirit, absoluter Geist. And I thought that this chapter, this development of the spiritual being, Entwicklung des spirituellen Menschen, it's actually, it's quite similar. I mean, in this chapter, he has done exactly the same thing. He describes this development of the different spiritual practices from the animistic. Hegel uses different words like das Lichtwesen, the light being. So what I wanted to say is that, you know, Marco mentioned this inner guru, right? So there's this inner sense of being, what he calls the psychic being, right? So this, you know, inner witness, or maybe you could say that this psychic being is kind of this diamond, so an inner dynamic, so the diamonds. And just by reading this chapter here, I very much try to, you know, spot this in myself and develop this in myself, I think that it is possible to really step outside, to really just witness and have a higher view of oneself, a higher perspective that you can cultivate, and then look back and look down on yourself, and then from a higher capacity, from a higher reason, really figure out a broader perspective. And that's very much what I had just reading this text. And I think he also speaks about this capacity of really basically going outside of yourself. So you're looking at the world and you're seeing the world, you know, almost arising by itself, and you can develop this capacity of really being outside of your body. So you really you're really witnessing the world almost outside of your body, and using a higher form of reason. And that's, I think, is what he's aiming at. And also in a way that is judgmental, but it's not effective. So you're not reacting to things. You're not pushing things. You're seeing things as they are. You're using the geist or whatever. And it's brutally hard to develop something like this. But I think just by reading this, he more or less talked me into experiencing something like this. And if you get this right, you're not effective. You're trying to observe. You're using a higher reason. I mean, that's what I would call the inner guru. That's what, if you get to that state, you have this very, very, very short glimpses of being sane and seeing the world just as it is. And I sometimes have this moment, very rarely, but I have them more often if I meditate just a little bit more often. And being at this place where you seeing your life and seeing the world from a greater clarity, I think that's what he's aiming at, you know. And this type of reasoning, this type of geist that he's, or this type of unattached awareness, it's not personal. It's you're in a larger context. It's also always beyond oneself somehow.
We're going to have to put phenomenology of spirit on our book list.
Yes, it's.
I've always wanted to get into Hegel. I think I would if I had a group.
And you're reading.
When I read it 2 weeks ago, I thought that it's actually very badly written. The style is just terrible. You could do this stylistically. You could do this much better. You know, he was terrible stylistically. It's not very good, but it's a kind of language you wouldn't use today. No one speaks like this anymore. You know, in German, he uses words that, yeah. I mean, they're like ancient. It really has its own charm. This book, to me, I read it once completely. It's like a magic book. It has some magical quality to it, definitely.
Which book is it, Tony?
Phenomenology of Spirit.
Yes, in German, what's his name?
Das Hegelbuch.
Das Hegelbuch, okay.
Phänomenologie des Geistes.
Die Phänomenologie des Geistes, okay. Okay. No, because I once tried to read him, but I had to stop because I think, in effect, I perhaps it's me that I have a different perspective, but just a little closing observation. What you described, I think, is the intuitive mind, higher mind.
Yes, of course.
Whereas a psychic being is yet another dimension, but not better or lower or higher. It's again something that complements this higher mind and intuitive mind.
This works for me. All these different categories. If I think about it, you're a physicist. I've recently learned about diffraction and how waves can form circles that can interfere and cancel one another out or pass through. One wave can pass through another wave. And that's something that a particle can't do. A particle can't be at the same place at the same time the way a wave can. And this, I'm putting this in a very crude way, but I'm just saying that helps me to sort of, when I'm working with Aurobindos and all these categories, if they're arranged, stacked on top of one another, it makes no sense to me at all. But if I think of it as diffraction of different waves that touch each other, merge with one another, pass through each other, disappear, another wave comes, that makes so much more sense to me.
Yes, but it's also in Aurobindo. So, but nevertheless, there are different experiences which are different in quality, quantity, if you wish, not necessarily in a hierarchical point of view, but they are different. The psychic being is something that you have an experience of when you open your fourth chakra. And it is a chakra behind the heart in your spine. Whereas a higher mind experience, an intuitive mind experience, a human mind and overmind and supermind is the opening of a chakra which is above your head. So there is even in this three-dimensional physical universe, there is a distinction in our bodily structure, which doesn't mean that they are completely different things. They are strongly interrelated. They are both point of actions of a one and unique source. But
it's like going this way.
Yeah.
Then yes. There's this way.
Yes, and there's also the horizontal and the vertical.
And you can go this way at the same time.
Yes, exactly.
What is your relationship? What is your relationship to time at that point? From that point of view.
From which point of view?
For me, time is higher mind, over mind. A very linear tripartite structure, which we're all familiar with. We've all learned it. How to get to a place at a certain time and how to make those kinds of arrangements work. And that's great. Trains start on time or they're late or you figure it out. But then I think there's a very nonlinear kind of time where, I will suddenly have some sort of, in a very safe setting, a feeling of threat or something or a wave of sadness. And I'll realize that a very young part of me that was hurt or abused is starting to get reactivated. So that's something in the past, but it's in the present as well. And I believe that, and then there's a part of me that's not just older, but ancient, which perhaps was never born and never dies, which can modulate the affects of that younger part stuck in time. Stuck in the past, with the adult that wants to wake up and relate in a more compassionate way to others. So I think there's a different kind of time than the past, present, future structure that I believe Aurobindo is very sensitive to, and I believe that even more so Gebser. He talks about the aperspectival as a radically different relationship to time than the mental structure. And I think that's why we're feeling a lot of stress right now is because the mental structure is collapsing. The deficient forms of the mental structure, we want healthy forms of the mental, but it's the deficient forms of the mental structure that is under enormous stress. And that's why so many of the institutions and organizations that you know, we've relied upon just aren't working at all well. So I think this is how we start to heal these splits, is to be more sensitive to, you know, the wave. And also, let's respect the particle, our particle nature as well. We need both.
Yes, but this is why I also liked Sri Aurobindo, because he has no notion of time at all. He, for him, past, present, and future is one. There is no division.
Yes, but he's not. He doesn't have to get up and go to work tomorrow, catch a train. You know, sorry? He doesn't have a boss who's going to fire him if he doesn't smile to the customers, even if he feels like shit. I mean, Aurobindo was in a very privileged setting. And that's why I don't think a lot of his, and he was, all he had to do was study very, very subtle levels of mind. That was his job, and he did it beautifully. But that's why I'm saying we live in a very different world than he did. And even I think most of the humans on the planet during his lifetime were not so privileged. I'm a very postmodern perspective here, and I admit it, and I may be a little excessive in some of my claims, but I also admit that I look around me and I don't see, I see brilliant people, and I see very smart people and very creative people, and some are making gestures of tremendous generosity and kindness to others, and I want to pay attention to that. But I also see a lot of, you know, people who are very criminally prone, you know, who are getting huge, reaping huge benefits from that. So I think that we all have different metaphors that guide us, and I believe we need more metaphors, and we shouldn't get caught up and trapped in the metaphorical constructs of people who, you know, already, like Aurobindo, as brilliant as he was using the Upanishad in a very unique way, and he was recreating stuff in his own in that particular tradition. And I think that's what we need to learn from him, and find how we can apply that kind of flexibility and creativity in the unique situations that we are in today, which are very different, I think.
Okay.
Speaking of time. That was wonderful. Thank you so much for that conversation. I think it's just what I needed too, going into this weekend. And I'm going to be carrying some of the field that we've created together here with me. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Marco. Thank all of you. Very, very enjoyable conversation. Thanks for
you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye.
See you next time.
Bye, Lauren. Bye, Oro.
Bye. You too.
Bye.
I'm not behind him.
Say hi right now, and then bye. Hi. They're all going.
Bye.
Bye.
Have a good night, everyone.
Good night.
Goodbye.
Good night, Aurobindo.
All right, sleep tight.
Oh, thanks, guys. See you next week.
Enjoy your bike ride, too. Looks like you're going out on your bike.
Yeah, trike and scooter. Huh. All right, bye, Marco. All right.
Good night.
Have a good day. Bye.